Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett. And tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you live from my home studio in Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. Coming up in the first half of tonight's show, award-winning indie filmmaker Frank Jacob is here to discuss Project Looking Glass, allegedly a piece of alien technology recovered from the sands of Iraq in the 1990s. Looking Glass is reportedly a black-budget time travel project that allows the operator to look backward and forward in time. And according to this amazing narrative, the elites running the planet are attempting to control and change future timelines for their benefit, not ours. Then, a group of former intelligence officers and military officials calling themselves the Guardians of the Looking Glass have come together to release classified information about future events. What are these messages? What are these future events? How can we change future timelines? And most importantly, is any of this real? Coming up in the second half, Finland has long been viewed as the land of sorcerers and shamans. In his new book, Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland, co-author Vesa Iidi explores the rich history of Finland's occultism, the light and dark sides of modern esotericism, ufology, the paranormal, why there's even a little true crime thrown in, and all chronicled with a heavy dose of that famous Finnish dry humor. But filmmaker Frank Jacob first taking us inside Project Looking Glass. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Frank Jacob is an award-winning independent filmmaker, editor, director, composer, creative designer, producing compelling documentary and commercial films for a diverse and exciting range of broadcasters and brands, from forbidden archaeology to sexy cars, consciousness to extreme sports, from story development to camera work, music, sound design, graphic design, and motion graphics. His films include The Klaus Donna Chronicles, Solar Revolution, and Packing for Mars. He's now working on a six-hour webinar series about Project Looking Glass and messages from a group of whistleblowers, the Guardians of the Looking Glass, called A Tale of Two Timelines. Frank Jacob, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Hi, Richard. Great to be here. How are you?
Very well, very well. And I know it's early in the morning over in Bavaria where we've reached you. I mentioned off the top that this looking glass technology was supposedly discovered in Iraq back in the 1990s. But what else can you tell us about where this technology came from?
Well, they found it they located it in the Middle East. The origin of the technology comes from these sealed cylinders, which apparently came originally from Sumeria, although the technology itself is not really Sumerian technology. It seems to be off-world or off-planet technology because it's very futuristic, obviously, and one wouldn't think that the Sumerians were that technologically advanced, although, you know, let's face it, we don't know that much about our ancient history. But it was essentially a technology which ties into natural phenomenon that take place on our Earth. So it seemed like it was a device that was left here or placed here to assist mankind in order to, you know, because it's a passive technology that allows you to see things, at least in that form of it, and seeing things that were going to come, of course, with the hope that you'd be able to avert negative things that are coming your way.
What does it look like? or what do we suppose it looks like?
Well, there's, from what I understand, there's several versions of it. And the most of the information that we have came from a whistleblower by the name of Dan Burrish. And there was, people can probably find some pictures. I think I uploaded a couple of pictures to your web server, guys. Maybe it was too late. I don't know. But there's a room-sized version, you could say. It fits into like a hall, and it's like a round device with, if you know that movie Contact, you know, it's interesting because we always talk about Hollywood being kind of like soft disclosure. But that you're probably familiar with the movie with Jodie Foster in Contact, where she's inside this device and in a chair, and around her are these moving spiral arms, really fast spiral arms, and you get this plasma forming and things like that. So it kind of looks like that, if you can imagine. There's room-sized versions, and from what I understand, there are also larger versions which were placed in Abu Dhabi and in the Middle East, which allowed for... you know, larger things to actually, penetrate through this field that is generated by these spirals that are spinning. And those devices apparently are placed in, there's a difference, the distinction to be made here between natural occurring, these portal points, like you could call them stargates. There's natural stargates, and they're all around our planet. And there's also apparently artificial stargates, which were created by, yeah, I guess you'd have to say extraterrestrial species, as a way to access or tap into our dimension here.
And who is in possession of this technology?
Well, as far as we know, it is in possession of the U.S. military now, or it was. And it was, you know, originally, I guess it was in the possession of allegedly Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi. Some people argue that the whole Middle Eastern war that took place had a lot to do with them going in to kind of take this technology. I don't know about that, or I can't really verify that, obviously. Maybe there are other reasons as well. A lot of people have said that there's incredible technology in all of the Middle East in those sands somewhere buried and hidden away. I've had some interesting confirmation about these kinds of portals that exist there from independent people that I've encountered over the years. So right now, I believe that, as far as I understand, it's still in possession of a certain clique, a certain elite that are using it or that are preventing others from using it in order to, of course, maintain the timelines, which is the main point of the device, in the direction that they would like to see them go, as opposed to allowing other people access so that they could maybe manipulate or change those timelines against their favor.
So how did the U.S. military know that they existed and where to find them?
Well, that's actually a longer story. It's very interesting because it has to do with something that started to take place starting in the late second half of the 1940s with everyone has heard of the infamous Roswell crash, of course, and there was a whole series of crashes that began to take place. And over the course of the next few years, I believe a number, about seven different crashes produced not only craft that were captured, but also the pilots in these craft. And as it turns out, they had to form a group that would deal with this, obviously, clandestine or information that they didn't really want to get out to the public. And that group later became known as Majestic 12. And the Majestic 12 group would essentially capture the technology, and their purpose was to obviously reverse engineer the technology. And in the case of the pilots that were inside these devices, they captured them as well. And they began a dialogue with these beings over the ensuing, actually, decades. And through these dialogues with these beings, they eventually found out that some of the navigational devices on these ships were also looking glass-related technologies. And the pilots eventually revealed that these technologies existed elsewhere, and that led them to search for them and find them.
And these, crash survivors that the military captain sort of interrogated, and they call them J-Rods. What does that mean exactly?
Well, J-Rods is a word that is it's a combination of letters that has that sort of used to define where they came from and what time. It's a strange way of putting it together. Eventually, it was kind of the nickname they gave them. It's not really a real name. It's a pseudonym, and it represents their kind. And as it turns out, their kind is, it may be technically extraterrestrial, but what they found out is that it's actually humans from the future. And there are different types of J-Rods, and they gave them names like P-45s. The P-45 J-Rods, meaning P-40 from 45,000 years in the future, and there were P-52 J-Rods from 52,000 years in the future. And what's interesting is that both P-45s and P-52s traveled back into time to this time right now because of what is about to take place on our planet. Has a lot to do with their future. And one group here is trying to maintain their future as it was. Those are the P-45s, which are considered to be kind of rogues, which are considered to be the descendants of the Illuminati. And then there's the P-52s, which are their 7,000-year descendants, which seem to have changed or developed something more along the lines of empathy for the human species as we are now, and have returned back here to try and alter the timeline that would actually lead to their timeline and their future disappearing and them being kind of orphaned humans back in time. So what's happened is kind of like a timeline war, if you will, that has ensued between the one faction of P-52s trying to help us to avert this coming event, which is about to take place, and we can talk about that, or the P-52s, which is trying to make sure that their future maintains and that they are here to actually, you could say, harvest genetic material or genetic information, which will help repair certain genetic defects that they encountered in the course of the next 45,000 years, which is, you know, where they ended up. The P-45s left the planet Earth and ended up on Reticulan. And they look a lot like the what we call the Greys. They have the big eyes and the spindly bodies. And these, according to the J-Rod dialogues and conversations, are essentially mutations that human species goes or encounters in the course of the next 45,000 years with exposure to space and the extremes that they are going to go through. So their idea of coming back here and harvesting via abductions specific human lineages, which I believe may have to do with their own personal lineages, because I have also encountered and read about how abductions always seem to take place within specific families or specific family trees. And another group that they encountered that both the P-45s nor the P-52s even knew about, which related to their past, was a group called the P-52 Orions. Those are the ones that actually, they're taller, they have light hair or white hair and large blue eyes. Those are kind of the more spiritual-oriented human beings that survived this coming event, which is about to happen, and went in a different direction, and neither of the other two knew about them. And they're all back here at the same time, the P-52 Orions kind of overseeing that there's sort of a non-interference from their perspective, the P-52s to try and make sure that we avert the potential timeline that's coming before us, and the P-54s that want it to happen. The only other group that I've heard about through, and this is through are the interviews that were done with the insider Dan Burrish, is that as a fourth extraterrestrial group, which are kind of interdimensional beings, but there's very little known about them. But they're sort of the fourth group. That's as far as the nutshell goes in terms of who the J-Rods are.
All right. So in order to give listeners maybe a better understanding of what project or what the Looking Glass technology is, I know that you kind of refer to other similar types of technology. Talk to me about the Chronovisor.
Ah, the Chronovisor, yes. The Chronovisor is a device that we learned about. I was working with Tanya Maidenford on our project, our film, Packing for Mars. And in the course of those filming, you know, these all the different interviews, we actually had we had Andrew Bishago, which I think you might know, or your listeners might know who that is.
Oh, yes.
He was part of our film, and he was talking about, as a child, being involved in something called Project Pegasus, which was sort of time travel and time viewing technology. And the first I heard of the Chronovisor was through Andrew Bishago, and he was describing it as kind of a viewing device that they would use to enter into kind of a space, like a bubble, if you will, that they created where they could peer into past or other, you know, time events. And they would use children to view these events because children had less filters than adults have, where adults have already established their own perspectives, their own preferences. Children are much more open to seeing what's really there and reporting back what they really saw. And so when I heard Andrew talking about it in the film, I'd never heard about it, so it sounded very fascinating. And of course, you have very little to verify whether these technologies really do exist. And I went back to Europe, and we were filming. We also made a film, Solar Revolution, which you mentioned. And in the course of making that film, the writer, Dieter Burs, was telling us about one of the guys in our film was by Professor Dr. Ernst Senkowski, who's an experimental physicist in Germany. And apparently, as it turns out, Ernst Senkowski wrote the foreword in one of the only books ever written about the Chronovisor. And they told us this, and we're like, what? Wow, that's cool. So we found out, we went and interviewed Ernst Senkowski, and it turns out that what Andrew was talking about was this guy called Pellegrino Ornetti, who was a physicist within the Vatican, who actually developed the Chronovisor. And this turns out to check out completely. And this guy really did exist, and Professor Dr. Ernst Senkowski actually knew him and had actually discussed it with him, and that's why he'd written the foreword to this book. So we had to go interview him. And as it turns out, the Chronovisor is something that taps into and ties into how amazing it is, right, how everything kind of relates. It ties into something, a theory that Pellegrino Ornetti had about remnants of events that are in the ether or in the magnetosphere, if you will, that he theorized should be able to be captured and tuned in almost like a radio device. If you could think of a huge dial, you know, that you would tune in and like a radio, but it would be tuning into these resonant frequencies. And he was trying to capture audio. He didn't realize that it was actually possible to also capture visual images. And apparently, so that's what he did. He actually captured these events. They were projected into the room kind of in a gritty holographic fashion, and they would film them. And the verification for us that this is actually possible came through our film Solar Revolution, when Tanya and I went to Sudbury, Ontario, to interview Professor Michael Persinger for Solar Revolution, because in Solar Revolution we're talking about how the cosmos is going to affect consciousness, which also really ties into the message of the looking glass that we got now. But he was talking about how the magnetosphere actually is this giant repository of everything that's ever been said, done, or thought. And that this was really where we draw a lot of our information from, if you will. When we first come into the world, we actually aren't coming here with a blank slate. We actually tune into specific frequencies and resonate with those frequencies. And that's how we kind of get our head start. So, and we're pulling information out of this magnetosphere. Perhaps it's past life information. You know, maybe that explains a little bit about some of the, you know, reincarnational experiences that people have. But so going back to Pellegrino Ornetti with his device, this is actually what he was locking into and he was projecting in the room. And when they filmed these things, of course, you can imagine the Vatican, they want to find out, was there crucifixion, you know, some of the major events in their past. And they, as far as I understand, the way Ernst Senkowski described it, you know, they brought the high brass in, probably some Americans, you know, Secret Service people, and they saw it, and it freaked them out, and apparently the project went underground and disappeared, so to speak. We now know, of course, through having filmed Packing for Mars, when Andrew Bishago was saying to us, is that somehow they took the technology from Ornetti, and they brought it over and combined it with some of the things that ARPA was working on with Tesla technology that had been developed with regard to teleportation over in the United States, and developed kind of a hybrid between the Chronovisor and teleportation, which ended up being Project Pegasus.
And we'll pick it up on that point, Frank, when we come back. Frank Jacob, award-winning independent filmmaker as we continue to delve into Project Looking Glass. We'll also get into the recently released messages of the Guardians of the Looking Glass on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. On July 12th of this year, NASA's Mars Perseverance rover captured an image of a spaghetti-like object using its front right hazard avoidance camera, A. The rover uses its onboard hazard avoidance cameras to protect it whenever it's maneuvering or while its robotic arm is in motion. The strange tangled bundle is theorized to be debris from when Perseverance first arrived on Mars back in February of 2021. You can check out the picture for yourself and read the rest of the story. That's in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. All right. When we come back, more of our conversation with Frank Jacob, live from Bavaria, filmmaker, and he's taking us deep inside Project Looking Glass right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dear independent filmmaker, award-winning independent filmmaker, Packing for Mars, Solar Revolution, and we're talking about this reportedly piece of alien technology, a looking glass discovered in the sands of Iraq back in the 90s and other locations, supposedly in the hands of the U.S. military. It's sort of a black budget time travel project, allows those that possess it the ability to look backward and forward in time. And in trying to understand what this technology does and what it's capable of, we were talking about similar types of technology, the Chronovisor, and Father Pellegrino Ernetti, who supposedly developed this for the Vatican. And that leads us into a discussion of Project Pegasus. And you mentioned Andrew Bishago, of course, who is the, I guess, the foremost whistleblower when it comes to another, you know, time travel piece of technology. So what is Bishago's story for those not familiar?
Bishago's story was that he was recruited as a child to be involved in Project Pegasus. Like I was mentioning earlier, they used children for their sort of, you know, innocent ability to view things that they encounter without their filter, the filter of an adult. So he was one of several or many children that were involved in this project. And what they were doing with this project was, on the one hand, they were using them to view into the Chronovisor these events and report what they were seeing. And Andrew has a famous story about him being sort of put into the scene at Gettysburg. And that at the same time as the Chronovisor was the one aspect of it, the other aspect of it was the time travel part of it, where they would actually jump from their original location, which was New Jersey, and they would end up in New Mexico. And they would spend like the summer there, you know, like, say, just to give you an idea of time, like a few weeks or a couple, you know, or like a month or two. They would do experiments, they would test them, and the locations like Leni, New Mexico, these sort of old abandoned mining regions that that Tanya and I actually, we went there and looked them up just to make sure that Andy's story checked out, and they did actually indeed check out. But they would then teleport, and then after they were done with their experiments, they would jump back to New Jersey, and they would appear back like hours later, kind of within the same day. Which was, of course, you know, kind of shocking for them, but they adapted to it, and it made it clear that they had never been gone, so to speak, to the people that they knew and their families, etc. They didn't just disappear for a few months, and then they soon, you know, figured out that they could use this technology for not just jumping from location to location on Earth, on different locations. That there's actually, these locations seem to be tied into, which, you know, plays into the looking glass technology, to these portal points. There seem to be these vortex points all over the planet where you can sort of tap into interdimensional, for lack of a better way to describe it, just almost like wormholes that go directly to other places almost instantaneously. But it turns out that not only can you go from one place on Earth to another place on Earth, but you can also go from a place on Earth to another planet in our solar system. For example, Mars, which is Andy's story, was tying into his having been involved in the jumps that were going on Earth. And then subsequently later, he was taken on jumps that led to Mars. So the idea of these kind of wormholes being used isn't all that, you know, far-fetched, as crazy as it sounds. And of course, nobody in the official branch of science is going to come forward and say that this stuff exists. We know that because essentially there is two branches of science. We know the science that takes place in the universities, university-level physics, if you will. And then there's the science and the physics that takes place behind closed doors, black ops projects privately funded, which, you know, leads us to the kind of technology which would appear to be magic to us, but is really just tapping into these other known, other known qualities of the universe, if you will, that they have discovered and are working with.
Right. And when you say you checked out Bishago's story, and I guess when you were filming Packing for Mars, you went to some of the locations that he described. And he talked about this, you know, elevator to Mars, and described this building. I think it was in a neighborhood in Los Angeles where you'd never been. Tell me what you found.
Well, that was bizarre because I was doing filming in Hollywood, and I was Hollywood Boulevard, et cetera. And I'd organized a line producer because I wasn't familiar with Los Angeles, and I needed some help just kind of get the locations and helping maybe get a second cameraman so I didn't have to film everything myself in this case. And after we were done wrapping on Hollywood Boulevard, I took the line producer to this location. I said, here's this address. Let's go to this place. Apparently, there's a building there with some strange-looking elevator shafts that stick out the top, and we found the building. And so we went up to the building, and it was a really strange experience. It was like bustling, you know, everywhere else around, but this one building, there was this huge parking lot in the back, and it was completely empty. And it was just the strangest thing. It was like this one building was isolated in terms of activity. There was very little going on. So as soon as we got there, I turned on my camera, and we started to explore, of course, this parking lot and some back things. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, this security guy pops up and comes whipping across this parking lot and stops me. And tells me to stop, and, you know, says, what am I doing here? And I had to make up a whole story. The line producer had kind of longish hair, and he was an Austrian. And I said, oh, he's this rock star. We're looking for some filming locations for a video of his. And the guy said, well, you're going to have to wait here if you've been filming or taking any picture, or actually you've been taking any pictures. I didn't say I was filming. That was a very good idea, as it turns out. So you know how it is with these DSLR cameras. They always give you a keyframe. So I'd been filming in different locations. The first frame is the keyframe. So fortunately, I filmed a tree before this one scene that captured the whole thing where he raced up to us and you could hear his voice in the background. And the guy gave me a choice. He said, either you erase everything you photographed here right now, or I'm going to have to take you in and we're going to have a talk with some of our people. And you know, so it's your choice. And I'm, of course, my poor line producer friend, who was this innocent student of, you know, film school, he was just freaking out, thinking, what had I gotten him into? So I just said, okay, no worries, I'll erase the picture. So I went through them one at a time until I got to the tree keyframe. I said, oh yeah, that was one we shot in Hollywood just a few hours ago. And the guy accepted that, so I got away with it. So that was our little excursion scene at that building, and it does indeed exist. And it is very, very strange that building does have those shafts sticking out the top. So Andrew's story checked out once again in that regard, although we didn't get to go inside the building, of course, which would have been, you know, the coup to top, but you know how it is.
Right. So getting back to Project Looking Glass, and we took a little slight diversion there because there are related technologies, one of which was the Chronovisor, which we talked about, and then this whole Project Pegasus. But getting back to Looking Glass, in order for us to understand what it does, and which will lead into this discussion of the guardians of the Looking Glass and their messages, we need to understand this concept of timelines and potential futures. Help us understand how these timelines, what they are and how they work.
Okay, well, timelines essentially it's the way you can think of our reality, or the one that we, you know, that we're living in, the things that we experience, the headlines that you read in the newspapers. There's a certain consensus that we seem to all, like, if you look at all of humanity as kind of a soul family, you know, we've all incarnated here, we're living here together, and we have a certain consensus of reality that we need in order to have a playground, because we're here to experience things, for trial and error, and to learn, to grow, to evolve spiritually, etc. And the consensus timeline is the timeline that we as individuals resonate with collectively. That is consensus to where we want to go in the future, the future that we're pointing at. Now, each of us, of course, individually, with our own decisions, have our own unique timeline, you could say, which is true. I mean, the thing is, you could, Richard, decide you're going to go to the store, and at the last minute you decide, oh, you have to do something quickly before you go to the store. But in another version, you didn't think that. You decided to go to the store right away. And then on the way to the store, you know, because you went a few minutes earlier, you ran into somebody that you hadn't seen in a while, and you stopped. And in the other version that you went later, that person wasn't there. So you create these individual tailored timelines for you yourself personally. But the bigger timeline, the consensus timeline, is still there, which is, you know, what you need to kind of have something to hold on to in terms of evolution in your own personal reality. And each of us resonate. You know, we have a resonance in our being, and the resonance ties into the resonance of the consensus timeline. And the more you resonate with the consensus timeline, of course, the more you're bound to accept its picture of reality. And if, you know, you believe what you're seeing in the mainstream, if you believe what you hear on the news, and you believe what you're being told in the schools and in science and in, you know, all the public events, the political events around you, then you're going to invest in that timeline. You're going to anchor yourself into that timeline, and you're going to give that timeline much more solidity. However, there's also the option, like, let's just look at that timeline, for example, that we're in. The timeline that we're in right now, the consensus timeline, is the timeline that is leading us to a kind of transhumanist future, a future that is dominated by artificial intelligence, a future where they're telling us, for example, we're going to have limited resources, that we're carbon polluters, that we're going to have global warming, that we have to change and alter our future to adapt to that kind of way of living that is going to have less impact. So they're selling us all these ideas. At the same time, they're using technology like AI and transhumanism to, you know, the wet dream of Ray Kurzweil, one of the main proponents of transhumanism, is to actually transplant the human brain from analog carrier, which is our human body, into a digital carrier and, you know, on a hard drive, and stick it into some sexy-looking robot and become immortal. Because that particular, you know, way of thinking is, you could call it materialism. These people do not believe in God, right, or a spirit or a creator. So they're trying to
shape the consensus timeline.
Yeah.
They're trying to shape it.
Exactly. So that is the consensus timeline that, it's, unfortunately, or, you know, for better or worse, we are on right now, because they have the technology, they have the money, the budgets, they have control of the media, the politicians. You know, we've seen Klaus Schwab in the World Economic Forum bragging about how he's implanted agents of his World Economic Forum, which he calls young global leaders, within virtually all of the governments of the Western world, so that they are following through with the ideologies and agendas that are prognosticated by these people looking to form into a transhumanist future. Now, at the same time, okay, there's another, let's just call it a timeline. There's another timeline probability, and that probability has more to do with an organic future, as biological humans, which have not really completely developed the qualities that we as human beings have dormant within us. We can already see what some of those qualities might be when we have, you know, anomalies around us, people that have special capabilities, that have telepathy, people that can move objects telekinetically, people that have extrasensory perception. These are examples of some of these dormant qualities, which you might say are locked into junk DNA, or some people call it that we only have two DNA strands and there's actually 12 DNA strands. Whichever way you want to identify it, there's this sort of secret hidden potential in the human being. And you know, we hear from people like J.J. Herr talk about this human Bauplan, that there's the celestial building like blueprint for humanity to actually make a quantum leap, evolutionary leap, so that we tap into those qualities and we actually form into a society which is more along the lines of an organic, biological, superhuman kind of timeline. And that is kind of where we want to go, because that's the direction that would lead us to our fullest potential. Because let's face it, Richard, what might be going on here is if the people that are pushing the transhumanist timeline have their way, we could be looking at those around us right now as the last generation of natural biological human beings. We've got Neuralink, Elon Musk. They're all trying to wire us into the network. They're already starting to what they call enhance the human biological system with these artificial technologies. And if they have their way and they continue along this path in the next 20 years, which, you know, Yuval Harari, who's their kind of like prophet of the new age in these circles, says, within one generation, we're going to be realizing this sentience in an artificial bubble. And, you know, the other aspect that comes to it is that if we look at ourselves as, rather than materialistic beings that are just formed by atoms and molecules randomly, but that we're actually divine beings that are creator beings, we actually have, you know, we're creators. So,
right. So I've got to jump in here, Frank. Excuse me. We're approaching the top of the hour here. We'll continue this conversation after. But one timeline is this dystopian nightmare, artificial intelligence, super surveillance states, where we are sort of delegated to, you know, serfs serving the elites. The other is a far more promising future. So how is the project, or how is Looking Glass being utilized with respect to these timelines? We'll discuss on the other side with filmmaker Frank Jacob on Coast to Coast AM.